So continuing with Taffy Bowen on 24th December, 73.
So I found myself in a very lucky position. We started to explore the Minerva Foundations. I found myself in a very lucky position vis-a-vis my wartime associates in the radar gang. That the I was good friends with Van Bush, who was chairman of the RC, ex-president of MIT, Carl Compton, ex-president of MIT, and the chairman of the what is called the Microwave Committee that spurred all that effort. Was Alfred Loomis.
Of the radiation lobbying?
Yeah. That and the corresponding efforts was Alfred Loomis. I'm going to see him next week. He's a millionaire, multi-millionaire, Wall Street lawyer who has a history of supporting science. His grandfather had a laboratory, his father had a laboratory, he had a laboratory at Tuxedo Park, and he used to support people like Wood, what's his initials? The popular man at Princeton, was it?
Wood?
R.B. Wood?
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyhow, there's a famous...
Optical astronomer?
Not an astronomer.
Oh.
Interferometers.
Optics. Yeah.
There's a classic university book on
optics
by Wood. I think it's R.W. Wood. He supported him. He was interested, Loomis, in accurate time. Do you remember the shot clocks?
Yeah.
I think there's one of his clocks in the Smithsonian right now. But the easily the most accurate clocks in the U.S. in the 30s or maybe the late 20s were the shot clocks, pendulum clocks. And gradually during the 30s, quartz crystals took over from those clocks. He established those standards.
I see.
So that was his interest in science, but he became interested in microwave radar, was chairman of the NDRC's microwave committee. He was a trustee of MIT, trustee of Caltech, at different times he'd been a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, and he knew the Ford people.
Right.
So when this question, and I'd been, every time I was in the States, I'd talk to him, to Van Bush, Mel too, here at ETN.
Yeah, I just talked to him last week.
Yeah. About the possibility of a big dish and maybe get that kind of money and so on. And first to come to the party were the Carnegie Corporation, of which Van Bush went back to be president. And I forget whether he pointed it out or whether Loomis pointed it out, but they had $250,000 tucked away of money which should have been paid out to the Commonwealth. To Commonwealth countries by the edicts and so on during the war, but hadn't been paid out.
At that point, you were glad you were still a Commonwealth country.
Right. So it took about a year and a half to do the groundwork. That was the first grant we got, and it was entirely, we knew it wasn't enough to, it wasn't enough to build an antenna, but it was entirely gratuitous in the sense that. We could do anything we liked with it. In the radio astronomy, we didn't have to build a big telescope. We could, it didn't have to be matched by other funds.
Right.
Which is very benevolent.
Americans didn't have to observe on the telescope or anything like that.
And I think the only proviso, knowing that we had to have more money, they didn't actually hand over $250,000 until we had something like the total sum. In other words, they keep it in the bank and get the interest on it. Shortly after that, I was put in touch with Rockefeller, of which Loomis, I think, was a trustee at that time. But Warren Weaver was head of the physical science in the Rockefeller Foundation, and he went back to the wartime years. Particularly interested in anti-aircraft gunnery and made use of for that. So we had a very good friend there, and it wasn't long before we had $250,000 out of Rockefeller. In that case, he was quite canny and very forthright about it. He said, look, there'll be no announcement yet, but you have this money, but I can tell you you've got $250,000, provided you can get from the Australian government an assurance that this sum will be matched 50-50 and any other sums. He knew about the Carnegie.
Right.
And I had the simple task of going back to Australia and well, first getting the assurance, which I got from the then chairman of CSIRO. He said, I'll go and see the minister this afternoon. He didn't go and see the minister, he went to see the Prime Minister, Bob Menzies, and he got the assurance the next day.
And when was this?
Assurance of the Australian
When was this?
Around about 56.
Oh, it's that early, I see.
Right. Yeah. I think the Carnegie grant was 55. This was around about 56 or 57.
So this was 5 or 6 years before the telescope appeared, yeah. Because you didn't have final designs or anything for the telescope.
No, we had a pretty good idea what it was going to look like, but we didn't have an engineering design. So the first step, and this was well understood by Carnegie and Rockefeller, the first thing we do is to get a design study. We had Peel and Fox lined up in London to do it. And they spent 3 years. That we had to have the assurance that we had nearly all the money before we started the design study.
Right.
So, oh dear, oh dear. You'll find it in some of those papers that I wrote about the origins of that telescope, the dates at which we placed contracts with William Fox.
Right, yeah, I can check that.
Yeah, but it was around about 56 or 57. And we placed a contract then with MEM for construction. In July 58 or 59, I remember July, I was up in Germany doing it. We canvassed.
Right.
Worldwide contractors, they had easily the cheapest price and the earliest delivery. And appeared to have the most confidence, as it turned out. And they did a wonderful job for us.
Yeah.
So it was 2 or 3 years generating interest and finding the money, 3 years design time, and it took 2.5 years to build.
And the building went rather smoothly compared to many other big dish projects.
There were no delays. We actually had 21 months, was it? No. Roughly 2 year completion time quoted by MEN, and we had a penalty clause on them. And they actually missed their completion time by 3 months, but we didn't impose a penalty. They did so well.
Yeah.
No hitches of any description.
What is the relationship between this dish and the very similar Goldstone dish?
Oh, we give all the engineering designs
to NASA.
We work very closely on that. At one stage, we almost got Freeman Fox in as consultants, but there was a contractual hitch as between US and Great Britain. So that didn't come up, but we were very close, and I might say we earned a lot of revenue from it. I think we got another $250,000.
I see. Useful byproduct.
In grants, which we finally used to reskin the...
that's the two or three years ago, the resurfacing.
It's reskinned out to the tripod legs.
Yes, I know, yeah.
It was good for 2 centimeters. And that was done with NASA money, which... Now, the interesting thing, NASA gave us that money to do engineering studies on this dish, which would be fed back into NASA. I mean, we did the shape characteristics, characteristics, that kind of thing. But particularly, we do studies of the methods of measuring accurately this kind of surface.
Right.
So all that work that Harry Manette did
on
the theodolites and all that kind of stuff was in effect paid for by NASA. And we had enough money over to reskin the dish.
But let me ask a more general question. It's not clear to me exactly why Australia and England led the way in radio astronomy for 10 or 15 years, and the U.S. lagged so much behind, when in almost all of the sciences, the U.S., largely because of its size, is way ahead. Do you have any ideas?
I can't really answer that. The reasons why Australia and the U.K. were in it, of course, it got quite clear. It came straight out of the radar business.
Right, but then why not the U.S.?
Why the U.S. didn't pick it up, I just cannot understand. I've never understood it. And I think I can only rationalize it by saying that there was such a tremendous effort on nuclear work and thereafter of nuclear work in the U.S. that absorbed some of the best people. This was some of the best people who had been involved in the radar thing in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, this was not to the United Kingdom or not to Australia.
And the radiation lab didn't exist after the war, of course. It was split up.
Yes.
And
well, all the best people went back to their habitats, as it were, and all appeared to be completely absorbed.
Yeah. Although, of course, that happened in England, and yet, I guess it's largely a matter of person.
But it was just the two. Well, the two. Hay didn't carry on conspicuously well. I mean, he was too much absorbed in. There's a good example. You see, the man who didn't get as deeply involved as he might have after the war.
Yeah, it was only about 2 years, and then, and then apparently he
got off. Whereas Lovell and Ryle both were in positions at Manchester and Cambridge where they could follow on.
Yeah. So my point
is not a very satisfactory answer.
Right. So I'm saying that even if there had been someone with Ryle's temperament at the radiation lab, he could have gone back and started his own effort. Right. Apparently, anyway.
Tricky.
Yeah. Right. If he focused on radio astronomy, he might have been such a person.
Well, you can almost name them. There's Dickey, probably the most conspicuous example. Lawson was another one. Do you remember him?
No, Lawson.
Lawson. He did an awful lot of antenna work and front end, noise temperatures, and I think he was at that end of the piece and received, good receiver man, but he went to the GE, to the nuclear, the NOAA nuclear research lab at GE. Well, that put him out of the running. Looked like Louis Alvarez could have, you see, but he went past that much and back to Berkeley, so that put him out. These are the kinds of people who could have done it.
Or Southworth. What did Southworth
do? Well, no, I think the Bell Lab would always be inhibited, you see, the reason that Chansky was. But they could do these things as a sideline, but they couldn't go that out.
Didn't make a major effort with it, sure. Well, I think that, unless you can think of some other comments you'd like to make, that covers it very much.
Yes, well, I've skipped the latter part, obviously, very much so, because it's all pretty well in the literature.
Yeah.
Well covered.
Right, it's the early part that's of particular interest, sure. Thank you very much. That ends the interview with Taffy Bowen on 23rd December, 1973 at the Australian Embassy in Washington.